really happy to be here to talk to you about something that is a sort of rising epidemic of this acute lung injury due to e-cigarette use and vaping. I encountered this through a patient that I took care of in the hospital medicine service about 2 months ago, maybe a month and a half ago, and was very interested in it, and have spent a lot of time learning more about it since, so I'm happy to share that with you today. Typical disclosure side, I have no disclosures. I was rereading my slides this morning, as I usually do, and noticed that it says that the activity will not include discussion of unapproved or investigational uses of products or devices. And I guess I will certainly not be recommending that, but it is the unapproved use of some of these devices that is part of the problem. The learning objectives are pretty straightforward. Most importantly, I think, for all of us who are practicing is to recognize the very broad spectrum of presentation of this, what's now called E-VALI, which is e-cigarette and vaping-associated acute lung injury. They were calling it VAPI, or vaping-associated pulmonary injury before, and they changed it. But it's very broad, and I think that's one of the things I've learned through this, so I want to make sure I get through how broad the clinical presentation is. We'll talk about the epidemiology of vaping and e-cigarette use and this cluster. And then finally, a little bit about the public health response, what the reporting mechanisms are, and what the CDC is now doing as of very recently to track these cases. This is sort of the same thing, a roadmap we will talk about in sort of this order as I go through. Okay, so this is a headline from the New York Times from October 10th. It's very fresh. Talks about nearly 1,300 cases and 29 deaths. That's already outdated. I think it's 1,479 cases as of the 15th of October, a mere 5 days later than this report, over 30 deaths. So it's really a very rapidly rising epidemic. Something that occurred to me, you'll see the devices, this little flash drive I brought my talk on, they look like that. There's an interesting couple of photos from the internet, these memes the teenagers put out there, picture a bathroom with stalls and it says, why are there urinals in our vaping room in the school? And, you know, it leaves no smoke, no odor. It's very easy for kids to use this stuff. This is the most recent EpiCurve from the CDC website, a pointer, but you can see it sort of really takes off. This is this year in late July. The CDC in one place says the first case reported was August 4th, I think. And it's really exploded. The orange is the date the symptoms started, and the blue is the admission date. There is a lag here, and so they point out that the sort of drop at the end is probably due to delays in reporting and their new system for reporting. If you're optimistic, maybe the public health response is beginning to have an impact on kids using this, but it's really quite dramatic. So this is a little bit more about the most current data from the 15th. Again, 1,479 cases as of October 15th that may be outdated already. It covers almost every state and one territory in the district, 33 deaths. We had a close call. One of the three patients at my institution was quite close and made it through, but was very, very sick. And what's interesting is they all share the characteristic that they're vaping or using e-cigarettes. Most, but not all, are using them in a way that they've added THC to it, but it is not universal. And most, but not all, of the products are not bought in the street. They're in some way adulterated, refilled. They've been doing things with them that were not intended. The most recent MMWR report from October 17th is a really great update if you want to read it. And I created a one-page summary of references that includes that and some others that, that I emailed in. Among a subset of those cases, about 70% are male, so there's a male predominance, and the mean age is quite young, in the early 20s, but you'll notice the range goes down to 13. There's a lot of teenagers involved in this. We have not identified a specific compound, and later I'll go into some of the potential culprits that are in vaping, but there's no answer yet as to what it is, and it may not be one thing, it may be many different things, and in fact, the disease presentation and the pathology and the imaging are quite varied, and it may very well be that there's different things. Among a subset of about 570 some odd cases where they had information, this is from the CDC's data of what people are using, about three quarters are putting THC into it, but that means a quarter are not. 32% it was exclusively THC, so they were using a device and just using THC instead of like adding THC to a nicotine. And more than half reported nicotine use, but only about 13% exclusively. So there's really no reliable, it's this one way of doing it. So a little bit of background on e-cigarettes, which is, if you haven't been tracking this, it's kind of alarming. This comes from the CDC's tobacco website. So they look like all kinds of stuff. They're extremely varied. Basically, what an e-cigarette or vaping device is, has three important parts. It has a battery, it has something that heats up a liquid called an atomizer, and then it has a cartridge or a pod that contains liquid nicotine. And they can be large ones that are refillable, they can be disposable, they can be super tiny, as you can see sort of in the middle picture. Those really look, are no bigger than a flash, tiny flash drive like this. And they can be coming from colors and flavors, and they're marketed really directly to kids. On the street or in the classroom, they're referred to by a whole host of names, many of which I didn't know. Things like ego. Ego, this is another name for, I guess, the high you get off of it. PV is like slang for personal vaporizer for the little ones. E-hookahs, mods, tanks, vapes, e-cigs, e-juice. There's a couple of interesting things that, again, I learned this through Dr. Karen Wilson, who's our division chief, who's very involved in smoking and tobacco cessation work, something called dabbing. So dabbing is taking apart the device and actually dripping directly onto the atomizer, a liquid of your choice, homemade concoctions of THC or CBD oil or other things like that. And they have all kinds of names that I did not recognize, like butter. And then hacking, as opposed to computer hacking, in this case, hacking means modifying the device. Like refilling cartridges, adding things to it, or again, dripping what's in the cartridge directly on to get a greater high. So amazingly, it's been just over 10 years since e-cigs hit the market. It's stunning how fast this has risen to me. The FDA tried to classify e-cigs as a drug delivery device in under what's called the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act in 2009, but this was challenged in court, and they were told they couldn't do it. And instead said it had to come under what's called the Obama's 2009 Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act. The market has grown to over $10 billion by 2017. I'm sure it's even larger now. And as you know, children can buy these things all over the place, in stores, online. I just went and looked online for a second. You can find all kinds of things you can get with no check of your age or anything of that sort. What this has led to, sort of typical, is a massive regulation and a real absence of effective regulation of these devices. In 2016, the FDA issued a deeming rule that extended their authority to these to try to based upon the classification as a tobacco or nicotine-containing product. And this rule would allow them to limit the sales, so only people over 18, require photo ID if you're under 27, get it out of vending machines, none of the free sample stuff, warning statements, et cetera. Unfortunately, the FDA delayed implementation of this. The current delay is to 2022, so we're not there yet. There's some rumors that it might be pushed up by 1 year, but so none of this has started. So states and localities have stepped in a very scattered and inconsistent way across the country. I actually don't know what the laws are here. I don't know if e-cigarettes and vaping devices are considered like cigarettes. So if you're in a no smoking zone, does that mean no e-cigarettes? But initially that was not true. New York City has banned that, applies the same rules. So New York City has issued regulations that make e-cigarettes exactly the same. So anywhere where you couldn't smoke cigarettes, you can't vape. But that is not true everywhere. San Francisco, as you know, banned all e-cigarettes, period, from the city. So they're way out ahead. A number of states have tried things, some without success. I think Michigan was the first state to ban flavored e-cigarettes. And I'll talk about the flavoring in a minute. Governor Cuomo in New York tried to do the same thing, but was challenged in court, I believe, by the manufacturers of Juul. And so there's a stay on that right now, so that has not gone forward. So it's really very varied. If you're interested in following this, if you're a kind of public health legislative addict, there's a law school in St. Paul, Minnesota, that puts out, I put the reference here, an amazing, very rapidly updated list of all the different types of e-cigarette-related regulations across the country. You can look it up, it's changing all the time. You can see it's all over the place. The other thing that I honestly did not realize until a month ago was just how rapidly e-cigarettes have overtaken smoking as a way to get kids addicted to nicotine. So this is from the National Youth Tobacco Survey from 2018. So it's fairly recent data, although I suspect it's even worse than this now. Over a quarter of high school students report having vaped in the last 30 days. Amazingly, you'll notice that e-cigarettes, it's now over 20%, and cigarettes is only 8%. When did that happen? It's overwhelmed the traditional tobacco products amongst teenagers. And 1 in 20 middle students admitted to vaping. I was talking to one of my siblings, right? It's very common out there in middle school. And in fact, I was polling anonymously some of our medical students. We have medical students who are vaping. They're under the impression that it is somehow dramatically safer than tobacco. So what happens when kids vape? They become smokers. This is a really great article from 2017 that was a meta-analysis that looked at studies of the risk of becoming a tobacco smoker, a regular traditional tobacco smoker, if you were a teenager who vaped versus teenagers who did not. And the overall odds, when you put them all together, you're 3.5 times more likely. At the bottom diamond, if you look at this traditional meta-analysis. Oh, here we go. Ah, there. Oh, not a very bright pointer. Anyway, the odds ratio is 3.5 times more likely, you can see it, to go on to smoking cigarettes if you are vaping as a teenager. And you might recall that part of the push from companies was this is a way to help adults quit smoking because it's safer than tobacco, and wouldn't you rather them have people vaping rather than smoking cigarettes because of all the health effects? But in reality, it's become an enormous gateway into nicotine addiction for kids, something that everybody suspected but was really ignored, very similar to, I think, the response of the tobacco industry way back when. So why do kids vape and use e-cigarettes all the time? It's mostly advertising. They are really exposed. More than 80 or 90% of kids in a really great, in the PATH survey reported having seen e-cigarette advertisements. And a lot of it is on the web and in social media, in a place where I, being a Luddite and older, am not so facile, but it's really remarkable. And the more teens and tweens that use it in record numbers, the more it becomes a social norm. And as I said, teens who with no tobacco use who use e-cigarettes are much more likely now, 3.5 times more likely to go on to become smokers. And in a particular interest, it's these flavored types and the advertising around flavor and menthol and fruit flavors that are really attracting the young. And this is just another graph on the bottom, again from the CDC, that shows the drop in cigarette use on the left and then the steady rise up to 27.5% e-cigarette use among high school students. So this is what teens see. I don't see this stuff because I don't go on Twitter, but this is all recent stuff. Juul, which is, I think, one of the more disturbing companies in this mess, really pushed a huge hashtag Juul campaign, and they stopped about a year ago, but it's too late. This is just a tracking number of posts that Stanford University has done. So they stopped putting stuff out in 2018. Juul officially stopped their campaign in social media directly to teens, but you can see the rise in posts. It has a life of its own. These are posts by kids with their vapes looking cool, you know, loser lover, so if you vape, you become a lover, et cetera. Very powerful marketing for kids, right? They know what they're doing. This is Blue, another one with their statement, we believe satisfaction shouldn't require sacrifice or compromise. Isn't it an alternative? It's a choice. And these are all young looking kids. This is all over the web. This is Juul, marketing flavors. So on the left, berry satisfying and cool mint. These are really enticing ads for kids. This is what they see. You know, people like me who don't watch television, just read the paper, and don't lurk in social media. And I don't know how many of you are also not social media lurkers, certainly people with gray hair, maybe more. I think we kind of missed it. I feel like I missed how rapidly this had. So this is why there's been a real focus at the states to try to do something, is to get rid of at least this flavored stuff and this marketing directly to kids on social media. With that as a background, let's switch gears and talk a little bit about e-cigarette and vaping-associated acute lung injury, so-called E-Valley. So I'm going to share with you two cases, actually. One is one that I took care of, and another is from a colleague that's in our New York State PEDS Environmental Health Specialty Network. By the way, the answer is there's 10 EPA regions, but there's 2 SUs in California, and then we have one in Canada and Mexico. So 13 in the main network. Lucky 13. So this is a girl I took care of, and it illustrates a number of things that I think are important to know. She was a 16-year-old with a unrelated, I would say, past history of a pseudopapillary tumor of the pancreas in 2015 that had been completely resected, and she had had no recurrence or problems since, but was followed regularly by our oncologist, who presented with about a week of flu-like symptoms, really. Fever, malaise, fatigue, some nausea and vomiting, some diarrhea. I will point out no respiratory symptoms at all. That was the first sort of revelation to me, is she did not present with cough or cold or shortness of breath of any sort, or wheezing. And also fairly typical, so a minority have no respiratory symptoms up front, but it's a significant minority. And also a majority present several times to some sort of outpatient care. And she had come at least 4 times for urgent care. At one point she had a urinalysis they thought was a UTI, not very convincing. By the way, the culture was negative. They treated her with Keflex. In her review of symptoms, we really came up only with the GI symptoms. There was really no, as I said, respiratory symptoms, shortness of breath, sore throat, headache, any of that sort. And this, again, is a minority of patients present without respiratory symptoms, but it is there is a significant number. We knew up front from her HEDS assessment and social history that she vaped. She did give different stories to different people, and her father was around, and it was sometimes hard to separate them and get an honest story. But it turned out, I think, the most reliable, gotten by one of my amazing residents who spent a lot of time with her, and this is before she got sicker, was that she'd been using Juul 2 to 3 times a day for the last 6 months, all exclusively flavored pods, again, as is common in this disorder, that she had obtained, she said, oh, they're store-bought, but actually she got them from her 16-year-old friend at school who claimed to have bought them at the store, so we really don't know, and she got frightened at the end when she got sick and tossed them all out. There was nothing to turn in. She did deny altering them or adding THC in any way, although you never know what's in the pods or the canisters if you didn't buy it directly packaged from a store. So that's the story we had for vaping, and we knew that up front, but we didn't really, again, in honesty, not recognizing that the absence of respiratory symptoms did not rule out vaping-associated lung injury, not much happened. So initially we thought she had a viral illness. She was quite febrile. She was having the diarrhea that was concerned about bacterial colitis in the ED. She was given lots of fluids. She got some ceftriaxone, and antipyretics, and she was admitted. And in the hospital day 2, doing family-centered rounds in the room, the nurse said, you know, I got a SAT on her that was 94%, but there's really no reason, right, for her to have a lower SAT. You're absolutely right. It hadn't actually been posted yet to our electronic health record. And then we noticed on rounds she just had a little bit of a cough. And I would point out what's interesting on exam that day by me and by others, it was completely normal, not have any abnormal findings on chest exam. Later in that day, when our pediatric pulmonologist came around, he thought he might have heard a few rails at the base, and perhaps it was developing, or either that or he has better ears. But it's also not uncommon for their chest exam to be normal, even in the face of more advanced lung disease. So knowing a little bit about this at that point, the recommendation is get a chest film. And that's what we got. Which I was kind of stunned by, because here's a girl who has no respiratory symptoms, or a little cough that just developed, clear lungs, she has this. So this was a little alarming and led us to make some calls. The first people I called was the New York City Department of Health, because I worked with them before, and we had a nice discussion about this, and we had a plan, which was to keep watching her saturations, which had come back up to like 96, but that if she required any oxygen or had worsening respiratory status, that we would initiate steroid treatment, and I'll come to that, and escalate the level of monitoring in her care because it get worse. And actually, a fair proportion of these kids end up intubated, like 20% end up in the ICU intubated. So this obviously shows a diffuse bilateral patchy infiltrates, mostly lower lobes. This could be mycoplasma, it could be many things. So again, we talked to the Department of Health. We also talked to the PICU, make sure there'd be room for her in case she needed it. They came by to see her, but she wasn't that ill at that point. We started azithromycin because atypical mycoplasma pneumonia was certainly in the mix. We had the plan to give her steroids if she would. 6 hours later, she's in the ICU that was really rapid. She developed more respiratory distress. She desaturated to the 80s on room air. We couldn't give her enough oxygen on the floor, and she ended up going on high flow and looked like she was going downhill and was transferred to the ICU. And we gave her, you know, 2 mg/kg of solimedrol and started her on 1 mg/kg Q6 after that, which is arbitrary. People have used different doses, and no one has a specific recommendation. It's sort of similar to what we would do with asthma, and so we went with that dose, and that's what many people have done. She did well there over 3 days. She did not get intubated. She slowly recovered, and then she came back to us on the floor, which we were quite pleased with. the pulmonologist wanted a CT, and this is a scan of her CT. By the way, she was very interesting, so we obtained patient consent for these photos. She was our picture of the week case, if you remember. So we have a standard way of getting consent for that, and obviously we remove the identifying information. But again, you can see these sort of alveolar infiltrates in the posterior zone. So this is the lower lobes of both lungs, pretty consistent with her chest X-ray. Before I go on to the second case, oops, doesn't want to go back. I will say that her infectious workup was very broad, and I didn't talk about it, but we have at our disposal, as I'm sure you do, PCR-based panels for GI, respiratory, blood, and CSF. We didn't do an LP on her, but we did do GI and respiratory panels. They were all negative, including mycoplasma, which is helpful, although the sensitivity is probably in the 60% range on the PCRs. And as I said, we treated her empirically in case this was mycoplasma pneumonia. All of her cultures and all of her infectious evaluation were all negative. Because she never got to intubation, she did not have lung biopsies or bronchoalveolar lavage, but that can happen. A comparison case, so we'll come back to it, but that first case actually meets the definition for a confirmed case for the CDC, for the purposes of the epidemiology of it. And I'll come back to why she does. The second case, which comes from Dr. Amy Brown, who's a pediatric pulmonologist at Maria Ferrari Children's Hospital in Westchester and is part of our statewide environmental health group, is a little bit different and interesting and is probably going to fall under the probable cases, although people might debate it. So this is a 15-year-old male, more typical since more of them were males, who had, an illness that began 7 days prior to admission that did not include respiratory symptoms up front, but was fatigue, had an episode of maybe syncope. 3 days before admission, developed abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, similar, and presented to urgent care. They are in urgent care, so at presentation, before admission, began to develop shortness of breath. There was a remote history of asthma, so they treated like asthma with albuterol. they treated for pneumonia and for atypical pneumonia, and admitted to a regional hospital where things went south, and was rapidly transferred over to Maria Ferrari, which is the Children's Hospital in Westchester. The vaping history for this child was he had been vaping for about 3 months and was described as a heavy vapor, first thing in the morning, frequently all day, and he was using black market pods and was adulterating it with THC. And this was Black Rock Cannabis, apparently, was the brand that is a brand that he was using. This is one of the more typical cases where there was adulterated liquid being used, as opposed to the case that I took care of where, at least according to what was reported, it was a store-bought Juul canister. So this child got sick very fast and developed severe respiratory distress throughout the first day at that regional hospital and went into ARDS and was transferred over to Maria Ferrari. Similar to us, the blood work showed elevated white count, inflammatory markers. But again, the broad infectious workup was negative, including that PCR respiratory panel was negative for mycoplasma. And then because this child got intubated, they did do bronchial alveolar lavage and found typical findings, which was lots of polys. They did many cultures, including fungal cultures that were all negative. And they did stains because I'll show you some of the reports of the pathology has been this lipoid pneumonia, but they did not come back. They did not stain specifically for lipid-related macrophages, but there's a lot of macrophages apparently involved in the cellular response. And cytology was, of course, normal. They gave broad-spectrum antibiotics. They treated for asthma just because. Interestingly, they had done mycoplasma antibodies, which we had not done, and the IgM came back positive later. And that's what makes this a probable and not a definite case. So it is possible that this is case of mycoplasma. But it's hard to know, and her illness seemed to go so quickly into ARDS seemed unusual for mycoplasma, but those things are possible. And as you may know, the sensitivity of the PCR is lower, 60-70%, depending on which study you look at. And IgM, which is what they got for mycoplasma, can be delayed some, and it was in this case, and that may be more definitive for mycoplasma infection. She ended up being intubated for 2 weeks, and eventually was extubated to high flow, and then back to the floors to room air by 3 weeks after her presentation. So she did recover. These are her studies that Dr. Brown provided to me. Her lungs look worse, and I think we would agree that the alveolar damage on her CT is more extensive than the 16-year-old girl that I took care of, but pretty dramatic. So let's talk a little bit about the larger cluster with that in mind. The best, the one publication, the peer-reviewed literature of a full cluster, not what's in the CDC data, which is larger but not yet peer-reviewed and published, is the one that was published this summer in the New England Journal by Layden et al. And this is from a couple of states that really put together their data quickly. And I think it's important to keep in mind, I think our cases are similar. So usually they're sick for about a week before they present. That was true in both of the cases I described. Generalized constitutional symptoms are present in all of them. They don't come in leading with their respiratory symptoms. Although most do have respiratory symptoms by the time they present or shortly thereafter, you'll see that GI symptoms, 81% in this cluster. Fever, about a third, tachypnea, tachycardia, and desaturations in about two-thirds. So the most prevalent sort of universal symptoms are generalized malaise and GI symptoms. They often have elevated white counts. They have elevated inflammatory markers. Both sedrate, procalcitonin were reported here. They didn't report CRP, but our patient had an elevated CRP, not surprisingly. 94% of the patients who presented in this cluster, which was again from Illinois and Wisconsin, were admitted. A third of them were intubated, which is part of why we preventively sent our patient to the ICU, so we wouldn't be doing that on the floor. And there was one death in that cluster. As you know, there's now 33 deaths, at least there were as of the 15th of October nationally. In a larger piece of the CDC cohort at that time, the CDC of 287 patients, almost 9 out of 10 received glucocorticoids, and the majority of those improved, which is why the sort of unofficial or maybe even official advice is to try it, because there's not much to lose and it seems to be helpful. This is the numbers of the size of the cluster keep changing because it's such a fluid thing, but this was information from the CDC that was presented as part of one of their clinical education calls. They have them about every week, and a whole bunch of them recently, these COCOA calls, have been about vaping, so I've been on some of them. And you can go online, by the way, and listen to them or get the presentations. But again, the age range at this point in this cluster was similar into the teenage range. And again, symptoms for this larger group of 339 kids, you can see, again, any GI, 77%, any constitutional, 85%. So to me, this was sort of a wake-up call. And then they all have abnormal vital signs, hypoxic, tachycardic, tachypnea. So what does it look like on imaging, which is it's kind of all over the place? This is a very recent study put out in this year, in 2019, that looked at 19 cases that these three authors at San Francisco, San Diego, and Wisconsin had looked at themselves, and then they pulled 15 more from the literature to try to see if there was a pattern of findings on the imaging on CT. And they narrowed it down to sort of four groups, acute eosinophilic pneumonia, a lot of alveolar damage, this lipoid pneumonia, which was a very small number, and then an organizing pneumonia. And on those they had pathologic specimens for, there was a variety of things seen, including a lot of alveolar damage versus interstitial damage that was quite varied. These are the pictures from their article, and I'm pretty good at reading plain films, but CTs get a little beyond me, but it is interesting to note some of the differences. So the upper left, the panel A, is more typical of what we saw in our patients. And you can really see the alveolar damage, more diffuse and opaque in the lower lobes, as opposed to D, the one on the kitty corner to it, with the interstitial infiltrate. I'm not good enough to say why this is hypersensitivity and acute eosinophilic, but the more common are those two there, certainly when we've talked about it with colleagues. So quite varied. And if you look at the pathology, it's really very interesting. I don't know if I can illustrate this. I read a lot trying to understand it, but This, you can't really see it. So in panel A in the upper left, what you can see is the airways where you see those bluer circles. It seems to be centered on the airway as if the toxin was inhaled through the airway. If you look at them up closer, you see sloughing of the, which is panel B, the respiratory lining and a lot of cellular infiltrate. And then if you look further out into the lung parenchyma in panel C, those sort of fluffy cells with the big cytoplasm, those are the foamy vacuolated macrophages that are seen in many, many cases. And then, of course, I think what we would have seen if we had biopsied the second case is the down on the bottom left is like ARDS, where there's really more extensive damage, a lot of hyaline membrane formation. It really seems to run the gamut, but it does seem to originate from the inhaled compound. So what's the problem? What's in this stuff that's causing this damage? And the answer so far is we don't know, and there are many potential candidates. There are all kinds of diluents that are added to this, and of course, because there's lack of regulation and because it's proprietary, we don't have a lot of information. There are oils, terpenes, squalene, things like diacetyl. This is a volatile organic that smells like butter, so it's a flavor commonly used as flavoring. I think it's used in the microwave popcorn. Petroleum distillates, including because they're solvents for the things you want in there, the nicotine and the THC, including PAHs. Then there's all kinds of lipids in there from oils. We've heard vitamin E mentioned, triglycerides, cholesterol, phosphatidylcholine, and things like that. There's, of course, the active ingredients, not the quote inerts, nicotine, the cannabinoids, THC, CBD oil. And then there's metals that are coming from the devices themselves, including nickel, tin, and lead. And then, of course, that maybe it's just the size of the particles. They're ultra fine. And part of the issue is that these devices are unregulated, so we really don't know what size particles are being produced by the different devices, which are not even being used in the way they were intended. So let me move on to what the response has been and what's going on now to investigate this. So the CDC is been updating this, and this is the most recent case definition. So this is not for clinical diagnosis, it's for reporting, for tracking the cluster. So our first case fell under the one on the left. So this is a working definition for a confirmed case. And it's pretty simple. You have to have used vaping or e-cigarettes at any time in the last 90 days before presentation. You have to have an imaging study, a chest x-ray or CT that looks like what you saw, something abnormal. And you have to have done a really broad infectious workup and found nothing. So our first case meets those criteria. She had a very broad infectious workup. We considered many things, depending on where you are. Fungal needs to be considered, sometimes Legionella. But if you've done all that and you find nothing, and there's no evidence, obviously, of underlying other rheumatologic diseases, for instance, that one might have known about. So that's a confirmed case for the study. The probable cases are very similar. Still the use of e-cigarettes, still the compatible imaging findings, but you've either done a big infectious workup and something comes up, but you don't think that explains the clinical course, or some of the infectious workup wasn't actually done, and so you can't claim to have done a complete infectious workup. So I think that the second case probably falls under this group, because one could debate the role of mycoplasma in that case, whether or not it was a concurrent issue or got sicker because, so maybe someone who vapes is more susceptible to severe disease from mycoplasma. So this is where some of the debate is. So the teaching, and this is what was really harped on by the CDC, which, by the way, interestingly, one of the people on the calls turns out to be a former PEDS Environmental Health Specialty Unit fellow who's now running the CDC lab, which was really great, Matt Karowski. And it turns out our fellow, Kevin Chatham-Stevens, is also on the team. Both of them went, as I mentioned last night, Basco went after their fellowships into the Epidemic Intelligence Service at CDC and have moved up rapidly there. So what they've been focusing on is asking, right? And even in kids who don't present initially with respiratory symptoms, we should be asking all of our teenagers about e-cig and vaping use whenever we see them in any encounter, so we have this in our minds. And if a child presents ill and has been, try to gather details. And I'll show you in the end, the CDC is now evaluating analyzing samples of these pods, biological samples, lung biopsies, BAL specimens, whatever you have, they've set up a way to get it. So you want to know what they're using, the frequency, what product, whether they are dabbing or adulterating it, and try to get hold of the samples. The other thing is to repeatedly ask. As we all know, teenagers are not always forthright. And so you have to keep circling back to this and sometimes have different people asking and making sure that you're asking without the presence of an adult who might disapprove. And then finally, collect if you can. We tried to collect the cartridges from our patient, but unfortunately, she was thrown away because she was fearful. It turns out the first, one of those urgent visits had been in our practice when she presented with flu-like illness, and she had asked my resident, she said, is it the vaping that's making me sick? And of course, her response was, of course not, you just have diarrhea and vomiting. We were wrong. A full exam, obviously, special attention to pulse ox. Even in patients who don't have respiratory symptoms, our patient would be a good example of that, where that was actually the first noted problem that led us, and it only was hours from that, really literally hours before she was really very sick. Be very aware that GI symptoms and generalized constitutional symptoms are very, very common, and the majority of patients have that, and they occasionally occur before pulmonary symptoms are noted. And that clinical lung findings often lag behind the imaging findings and the severity of the lung disease, again, as illustrated in our case. Do as big an infectious workup as you can. Keep in mind, use the PCR technology we have because it's really quite fast and good. Keep in mind things like Legionella and fungal pneumonias if you happen to live in an endemic area. So in order to do the best possible job we can to rule out infectious causes. Again, expect lab abnormalities with elevated inflammatory indicators and white count, sometimes elevated liver enzymes, not quite why. It's probably helpful to get urine tox. We actually hadn't done that, but it might, in terms of the epidemiology, they would like to know. People may not even know they're being exposed to THC, so the CDC would like that information. Even people, it's a specific recommendation who present with a history of vaping and GI symptoms, you should get a chest film. It's a specific CDC recommendation in the absence of findings, particularly if they're hypoxic, even a tad. Chest CTs may or may not be helpful. I can't argue that they changed their clinical course at all, but it's certainly helpful information in terms of investigating the cluster. But in terms of its utility for clinical management, I think it's debatable. Pulmonary consultation, obviously, when they're sicker, and they can do BAL and black specimens, both for diagnosis and investigation of infection, as well as helping with the study of the cluster. There's no specific treatment. It's all supportive care. If you find infections or suspect infections, you should treat for those along with support for the lung injury. Steroids are recommended because they seem to work, although, and it makes sense with the inflammatory response, but there's no specific dose or type or range of how to give it. And you'll have to make your own mind up whether to taper it depending on how long you need to treat with. There are some high-risk groups the CDC has identified. Older people, people with underlying cardiac or pulmonary disease, and pregnant women. We don't really know the extent of what happens afterwards. So obviously, we have to encourage these patients not to smoke and not to vape and provide them with support to help them do that. There's many, as you know, FDA-approved adjuncts to cessation therapy, medications that can be used, counseling, behavioral therapy, CBT. There's lots of options, and we should not ignore that because the worst, there are cases of relapse where patients leave and then they go back to vaping because they're addicted to nicotine. I didn't mention, but often you have much higher concentrations of nicotine in e-cigarettes than in regular cigarettes. So it's not easy to sit, you know, it's easy to say. It's very hard to do to just have them not vape or smoke afterwards, and you don't want them to go on to smoking because now they're afraid of vaping. So consultation with services that can assist you with that are pretty critical. There's a specific recommendation to follow them up because we don't know what the healing process is or whether there's a long-term lung damage. So the recommendation now is to see them in a couple of weeks, even if they're well, check a pulse ox, again, focus on continued use of nicotine-containing products, and then consider a follow-up eval, including a chest x-ray at least within a couple of months after that. That information may be helpful to CDC as they track this and try to get a handle on what the lung recovery is. Obviously, the long-term effects are not known. And in fact, we also don't know the extent of potential subclinical disease. As you've noted, there's a lot of kids vaping, and probably a minority are presenting with clinical illness. And we don't really know whether or not there is subclinical lung damage going on. That would be sort of an area to investigate. This is the timeline. I think it's impressive. I'm a big fan of CDC and EIS. So the first case, that possible case reported to them, they said was August 1st. And here we are, August 17th, as you follow it down, and they've put together tremendous educational resources, a cluster investigation, and they are now analyzing all samples. So blood samples, BAL, the capsules themselves, if you can send them in. All of this is done in collaboration with local Department of Health, which is how the CDC generally works. They often, and they've sent out EIS officers now to work with the local departments that have the larger cluster. So if you have any cases, have you had any cases here of lung injury? How many? Two? Yes. Wow. Okay, so it's, you're here, everybody's seeing it. You should contact your local Department of Health and submit, right? Samples go through them. But just again, just on the 17th, they started accepting BAL samples. So even for old cases, they may still be interested in it if you have them. And they'll do biological samples, and they'll do samples of the cartridges or devices. So clinical take-home points for me that I learned from this, and hopefully you'll remember, is consider it in any patient who has a history of any use in the last 90 days, who has infiltrates on an x-ray, or even who has flu-like symptoms without infiltrates or hypoxia initially. Never forget about infectious etiologies. Investigate them because it's important to find and treat them, but also because it's really important for the cluster investigation to rule out as many alternate explanations as possible. And give them steroids because it seems to work in most of the cases. I don't know if us being a little bit more alert and starting steroids early helped, but we were certainly very pleased that our patient didn't end up being part of the third of kids who ended up intubated. And then finally, sort of at the public health level, e-cigarettes and vaping devices are now the most commonly used tobacco products in kids by far. And this is a change in the last decade that's been very rapid. They are not safe, and kids and adults shouldn't use them at all. And the advice not to use them is really what we should be telling people, particularly if they've been adulterated or had THC or other things added to it. This vaping epidemic in kids is relatively new and rapidly growing. And in the short term is certainly causing new severe illnesses like E-Valley, but may cause other more chronic illnesses that we do not yet know about and are very alarming. And then of course, nicotine addiction is preventable, and we should wear our public health hats and get out there and work hard to try to get our states and the federal government to regulate this and ban the use of this, certainly ban the advertising to kids, much as we had to go through with Joe.